Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel. The Baseball America College podcast is brought to you by ATEC, the training machine company. ATEC, the baseball training machine company, is committed to delivering tools to coaches to help train and develop players. Visit ATECsports.com to learn about training machines that can help make your practice more effective and more efficient. See training tips and practice drills from Vanderbilt head coach Tim Corbin and more on ATECsports.com. ATEC, win every practice. I should start that every week by saying, John Manuel, enunciate every read, because I don't enunciate every word of that read. I'll do better later on the podcast, Aaron. But I'm actually
win every podcast, Johnny.
I'm throwing you a curve, though, Aaron. Right off the start, we're going to talk about Vanderbilt head coach Tim Corbin and the Vanderbilt Commodores. Not in our top 25, but very excited that we actually used the Commodore 64 headline last week. One of my best headlines I've ever written. Great headline, boss. And then, and how about Vanderbilt? I mean, the SEC, we've talked so much about this league this year because it deserves the mention. But what is Vanderbilt, the number six seed going into the SEC tournament? Number five seed? I forget what they are, but I mean, they're up there. They didn't just squeak in. We thought they were going to have a hard time. Pardon me?
No, number five. You're right. That's what they are.
Number five. And we thought that we thought Vanderbilt was going to have trouble just squeaking in to the SEC tournament. Now they're the five seed in a 10-team tournament, and Aaron, they were a top 10 team to start the year in our preseason rankings. That proved to be a little bit too ambitious for a team that young, but the Vanderbilt Commodores, they're not just making the regional. They're going to be a dangerous regional team. I'm not going to want to see them if I'm another team. But they have power arms, they have pitchers,
yeah.
They have left-handers. That's a pretty interesting ball club going into the postseason.
You're absolutely right, and they're peaking at exactly the right time. And, those arms that we thought would be dangerous have proven that they are. And, the last couple of weeks here, T.J. Pecoraro on the top of that rotation has been outstanding. Sam Selman now for 2 weeks in a row has gotten the job done in the rotation. And Zomek moved back into a starting role and pitched well on Saturday this week. So, Their pitching has come together, and obviously they've got depth on that staff now. I mean, if Tyler Beattie is your fourth guy now, and you've got Drew Verhagen throwing 96 miles an hour, and Will Kleiner the veteran at the back, and Brian Miller kind of giving you a different look, it's a nice group. I mean, they've got good arms, and certainly this isn't as offensive as last year's team was. Of course, I mean, now that Westlake and Esposito and Casale are gone, we've talked about that, but they do still have those veterans, those Omaha veterans: Tony Kemp, Mike Yastrzemski, Anthony Gomez, Connor Gregor, Connor Harrell. I mean, Riley Reynolds is back now. These guys were all regulars last year, for a College World Series team, and then you throw in a couple of newer, talented, younger guys that have played well. I mean, Spencer Navin behind the plate has really done a fantastic job replacing Kirk Casale. And providing some offense as well. I mean, that's been a guy that's kind of gone under the radar, but has been a big part of their success this year. Because coming into the year, they were worried about that. They were maybe not worried so much as just, uncertain how that was going to go. You're replacing a senior catcher. That's hard to do. That was a question mark for them, and he's really handled it.
It's a great way to put it. I mean, the things that they thought were going to be worrisome coming into the year haven't necessarily been in some ways. Their bullpen's been pretty good because Kleiner, early in the year, the issue was they couldn't get the ball to Kleiner with a lead, But he kind of has led that kind of new-look bullpen. And then they've had this sophomore catcher from Iowa, like you said. I mean, really stepped forward, and he doesn't have Kirk Casale's Northeast toughness, nor does he have Kirk Casale's Northeast beard. But but he's been very solid back there. So those things they kind of thought might be issues, they weren't issues. The issues were really, Connor Harrell striking out 50 times, Conrad Gregor not hitting early in the year, and then their pitching staff being a little too young. But it really seems like things changed for them when Pecoraro, coming back early from the Tommy John surgery. The only guy I can think of who's come back as quickly from Tommy John was Brandon Clausen, who did that at the big league level with the Cincinnati Reds after being traded by the Yankees. And his career wasn't very long-lived. T.J. Pecoraro, let's hope for a little bit more staying power for him. But, I mean, he's just been outstanding. Looked very good on national TV Thursday night against Ole Miss. Big sweep for the Commodores this weekend. So 16-14 I think they're going to be a dangerous team. They look like they could even be a second seed if they have a good tournament, Aaron. I mean, a fifth-place team and a fifth seed in the SEC tournament is usually a sometimes it's a one seed and a host. I mean, that's not going to be Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
But they look like they could be a very dangerous number two seed, don't they?
You're right. I mean, they're up to number 32 in the RPI now. I mean, if your top 16 teams are one seed, your next 16 teams are twos, I mean, that puts them in a two range as far as the RPI goes. And, you know, they have really played well down the stretch, and momentum is in their favor. You know, we know the committee looks at momentum.
Yep.
And, boy, they've got it. They've got it big time. I mean, they're in. Right now, they're a lock. I think they go 0-2 in Hoover, and they're still in the tournament.
I agree. I think you might. I think if I'm a Purdue Boilermaker, I'm starting to break down some film of Vanderbilt because I think you're going to see the Commodores as your number two seed and a very golden black regional up in Gary, Indiana. I mean, like that's something that we all mapped out at the start of the season. It's the Baseball America podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Baseball America podcast with John and Aaron. And let's talk about the top of this week's rankings, Aaron. Florida State, still number one. Even after losing that series at Clemson last weekend, we put the poll to bed last week on Monday with them having played one game in that series, and they played the doubleheader Monday, split it, but they lost that series at Clemson. They come back this weekend and win a series against NC State, even after losing the opener. Just not an obvious number one team in the country here, and Florida State's pretty much number one, I'm not going to say by default, but just because I think the top seven teams, Florida State, in our rankings this week, Florida State, LSU, Florida, Rice, Oregon, Baylor, South Carolina, those seven teams are pretty tightly bunched. And then 8, 9, and 10, A&M, UCLA, North Carolina, those top 10 teams, there's just not a lot of separation between those top 10 teams in my mind, Aaron. Not in terms of resume and their accomplishments during the 2012 season. Do you agree that the gap between 1 and 10 is really small?
Yeah, I do. I think you're exactly right. I think it's a great way to put it. You know, it's again, this is the second week in a row. We had a hard time coming up with a number one, and we probably talked about four or five different teams for that spot. I mean, we talked about Rice, we talked about Oregon, we talked about LSU, and even Florida, and Florida State. You know, so really you've got a bunch of teams that have a claim to be number one and have pretty similar resumes. I mean, actually, I think the resumes are similarly impressive, but they're not necessarily similar. I'm going to rephrase that because Florida State, for instance, you know, I think it's impressive that Florida State has gone 24-6 in the ACC and won that league running away, and they've really dominated. But you know, their resume doesn't include the kind of really impressive quality wins that you see on LSU's resume or Florida's or Oregon's or, you know, even UCLA's. I mean, I feel like Florida, it's just more of a, you know, you're impressed with their consistency, but they just, you know, the ACC is okay this year. I think, I mean, I'm frankly not blown away by the ACC. It's pretty good. I mean, I guess it's a pretty standard year for the ACC, John. I don't know what your take is on the league. You've seen more of it than I have, but
I think it's just okay. I think it's just okay. Yeah. I think that the thing is, Aaron, Florida State, you know, its top rival in the league is the other division winner, North Carolina, and they did not play. Like, so North Carolina's 10, Florida State's 1. They didn't even play during the regular season, and North Carolina finishes only two games behind Florida State, despite the fact that for 21 games they were without their best player, Colin Moran. Not just their best player. I mean, really, in the whole country, top five hitters in the country, who can you get the five just in position play, just in pure hitters, Aaron, that you'd take before Colin Moran? I mean, Chris Bryant, Mike Zunino. Who else would you take?
Colin
Moran.
You're right. He's got to be in this. I mean, he was a first-team All-American last year, and
With all due respect to James Ramsey, wouldn't you take Colin Moran over James Ramsey, just pure hitter?
Are we talking about long-term upside?
If you needed a hit right now, I don't care who's on the mound. If you needed a hit, who would you rather have, Colin Moran or James Ramsey? I'm taking Colin Moran.
I think I'm still going to take Ramsey. You know, I mean, the guy's had a filthy year. He's a senior. He's been through everything. I mean, I think you got to acknowledge that. I think Moran has more upside long-term, I guess. I think I go with Moran. I mean, Ramsey, sorry.
And then you have Christian Walker at South Carolina, I think, is in that short list. Rafe Rimes is hitting 469. Yeah. I'll put Rafe Rimes on that short list. Alex Yarborough at Ole Miss, I'll put on that short list. I mean, there's some dudes who are in contention, but so again, my point is that Carolina was without its, by far in my mind, its best player in Colin Moran. Even after he comes back, you know, you have some timing issues. To me, I think North Carolina is not that far behind Florida State. I don't think the gap between those two teams is very wide. And really the gap in the league is basically the U. Florida State swept the U. North Carolina got swept by the U. That's really the difference. North Carolina played Miami when they had Peter O'Brien and in Miami, and that matchup really worked very well for the Hurricanes with all their left-handed pitching and how left-handed North Carolina's team is. And meanwhile, when Miami played Florida State, just wasn't playing as well, and the Seminoles, to their credit, just took it to Miami. But really, that's the difference in the two teams, is that one series. And that's how razor thin I think the gap is between 1 and 10. And in the Southeastern Conference, it's similar, Aaron. We have LSU 2, Florida 3, South Carolina 7, Kentucky 11. Yeah, I think Kentucky slumped here toward the end of the year. And that's why they're toward the back of this ranking. Their non-conference schedule was the weakest, but their in-conference resume until this weekend, getting swept by Mississippi State, was the best. So just not a lot of difference between those teams. LSU goes to the top of them in the rankings because they won the league.
And if you look at Kentucky's resume in the league, you know, I know they finished, a half game behind South Carolina, I think. But, I mean, heck, you know, Kentucky won two of those three series against the other SEC Big Three. You know, they swept South Carolina, of course, and they took two out of three from LSU, whereas South Carolina lost all three of its series against the Big Three. So, I mean, you know, Kentucky, I know why they're behind. I mean, they finished poorly, and they, you know, they had the really soft non-conference schedule that hurt their RPI and is going to keep them from being a national seed. But, you know, as far as the higher end of their resumes, I think Kentucky's compares favorably with South Carolina's. So absolutely, I agree that there's not a lot of difference here. And you know, it's I don't know. It's going to be very interesting to see the way this unfolds. But I do feel like Kentucky has been exposed a little bit here these last few weeks. I mean, their starting pitching hadn't really been performing at a high level for most of the SEC season, and they were winning anyway because they've got a really good bullpen and a really good offense. You know, I think their bats went a little bit colder, and their pitching still just wasn't getting it done. So right now, you know, don't have a whole lot of confidence in Kentucky heading into the postseason unless they can get those arms figured out.
It's the Baseball America podcast with John and Aaron. Aaron, one thing I just dug up, it took me a while to find the ACC-only stats, but in ACC play, just for grits and shiggles here, James Ramsey, 286. I just have a 436 on base and a 533 slugging. So, but he has not dominated in the ACC. He's been good. He's not been otherworldly in league play. So I'm just throwing that out there. If you don't like it, throw it right back to me.
You got Colin Moran.
I'm curious what they are.
I'm sure he's.
I don't believe North Carolina's stats are that go that deep as Florida State does have the conference only stats, which I'm forever grateful for, and the ACC, which still to me does not value baseball as a league the way the SEC does. The league office does not push baseball, doesn't promote baseball, doesn't foster baseball, doesn't help baseball. You don't have conference-only stats on the ACC baseball website, the official league website. It's poor. That is poor. And now I'm jumping around a little bit, Aaron. We were talking about possible number ones this week. We discussed the possibility of Rice. We discussed the possibility of Oregon. It does feel like Oregon's resume is a lot stronger than Rice's, especially when we're talking about top eight national seeds. And at the same time, I almost feel like I believe a little bit more in Rice as a postseason team because their starting pitching and their bullpen have really both seemed to come around. And they had a big weekend series win just recently, obviously, against Central Florida, at Central Florida, to claim that Conference USA championship. Their 17th straight year where they've either run a regular season or tournament champion over three different conferences.
Yeah, exactly. And I agree with your ultimate assessment there. I think Oregon has the more impressive resume. You know, we've talked a whole bunch of times about those four weekends. You know, basically the other four top teams in the Pac-12. They've won three against all of them, and it's just loud to me. I think their resume is very impressive. 9-3 against the top 25 in the RPI. I mean, man, that's very good. Yes, I believe in Rice more as a postseason team. I think their pitching is deeper. I think their high-end pitching is better, more dominant. I mean, Alex Cadell's had an amazing year for Oregon. He can beat anybody. You know, he's a senior. He's a pitchability guy. But, I mean, you know, I do think that Rice has more shutdown arms. You know, I think Rice is probably more dangerous offensively as well. I mean, this is a great coaching job by George Horton. It's kind of a, you know, it's one of those teams that has overachieved a little bit in my mind. And, you know, I like Oregon. I think they're tough and scrappy, and, you know, you can't overlook them at this point. But I still can't get myself to completely buy in.
I'm with you. I'm with you. I mean, I think you nailed it. They've overachieved. That's both a compliment and a backhanded compliment. I mean, it's hard to believe necessarily that Oregon is a Omaha team, be a great story for college baseball, and they're sitting there at 5 in the Boyd's World RPI, just sitting there at 5 in our rankings, and their resume is better than Rice's. Rice down at 12, that leads me into our top 8 national seed discussion. Obviously, you're going to bear down this, you know, with the full force of Aaron Fitz's intellectual might tonight for tomorrow's stock report. But on the surface, Aaron, I think we have 5 fairly safe top 8 national seeds. One, to me, there's one lead pipe lock, and that's Florida. And I would say that Florida State is a 99.9% yes. lock.
As much as Florida for me.
Okay. Then you've got UCLA at 3 in these RPIs, on this Boys World RPI. I don't feel like UCLA is a lock for top 8 national.
No, they're not a lock. They're not a lock. I mean, because right now they're tied for 3rd place in their conference. But, you know, then again, Florida's 3rd place in its conference. I mean, I think UCLA is in very good shape. And you know, we talked about a couple of weeks ago how UCLA was about to go on the road for a couple of weeks in a row. They had a 9-game road stand, and they had to handle that. It wasn't a overly difficult road stand. I mean, they were playing teams that aren't going to be in regionals, but they handled it. You know, they went and they swept a series at Washington, who, you know, at the time was a borderline regional team, and then they went and you know, took 2 out of 3 at Cal. So they've handled this road stretch. I think they're 7-1 in their first 8 games on the road during this period.
Yep.
This weekend they did it without two up-the-middle starters, Tyler Heineman and Pat Valleca, and this kind of shows you what kind of depth UCLA has. And that's one thing we hadn't really talked about because they hadn't had to use their depth. They've been healthy, but they have a lot of position player depth. And this weekend, you know, they've got the luxury of 2 pretty good catchers. They, you know, Heineman was ill, flu-like symptoms, and so they moved Trevor Brown behind the plate, and, you know, they slid Kevin Williams from second base to shortstop, and, you know, it all worked out for them. But I think their resume is impressive, and now all they've got left is a home series against USC. USC is not very good, and I don't see UCLA faltering this weekend. I think they're going to be a national seed.
I'm with you, Aaron. The more you really look and delve into what UCLA has done this year, it's really, really impressive. I mean, they have the 4 series losses. They haven't been swept, I don't believe. And like you said, it's a pretty nice road finishing kick to show the committee right before the meetings outside of Indianapolis, somewhere in a remote hotel as they make room for the Indy 500. you know, they really don't have a significant weakness. They're just it's a really good balanced team. I guess their significant weakness is they don't have an ace, and they don't have a defined
right.
shutdown like 100. Scott Griggs is very good, but 56 strikeouts in 32 innings is really good. But as Kramer might say, he's a little bit flighty. So
right. I mean, I think Adam Plutko is a legit ace. I mean, he's not not a Kyle Zimmer, Mark Capel kind of, you know, 95 mile an hour guy, but he is. For me, I mean, he's as good an ace as any of these. You know, I mean, if Alex Cadell's an ace, then certainly Adam Plutko is as well for me. I think when you look at UCLA's resume, I mean, to me, it's been really impressive. They haven't always done this, but they've really, really taken care of business in the midweek. I mean, they've got
they've got
only a couple of midweek losses.
That's a great point.
I mean. And, you know, and And last year, I feel like they had more depth on the mound, and you would have thought they would have been better with the midweeks last year. But, you know, they've had Grant Watson, especially as the guy in midweeks, and they're 21-4 in non-conference, and they're 17-10 in a very good league. That's an awfully impressive resume, and that includes, you know, a series win against Baylor, who ran away with the Big 12. So let's not forget about that.
Absolutely. I mean, like, I think we started off the year with that inexplicable, not inexplicable, but that surprising series loss to Maryland, where I think Eric Backich really had the Terps ready to go right out the gate. That team competed all year, Maryland. I think you can give them a lot of credit. They didn't make the ACC tournament, but a much more competitive Maryland team this year, and kind of took, I think, UCLA a little bit by surprise, and also UCLA, you know, first time in 3 years without Bauer and Cole. But that team found its identity pretty quickly, and its identity was, again, a very balanced team. We've already talked a little bit about Oregon. The other team in the Pac-10, you know, Arizona just kind of train keeps rolling. They're a very offensive club, very good at home. Got Arizona State this weekend for them with a shot at the Pac-10 regular season, Pac-12 title. I want to talk about Stanford, Aaron, because this is the other team that seems to be finding its identity. First of all, Mark Appel has gotten hot on the mound, a couple of back-to-back just where he's shoving it. Brett Mooneyham remains shotgun command. I mean, that's a great phrase. You know, you never know what you're going to get with Brett Mooneyham, but it's a live left-handed arm. And now
he's been good lately, too.
He's been good lately. And now Stephen Piscotty, Aaron. Stephen Piscotty moving into the weekend rotation. That's a guy on your short list of best hitters, A. And B, the Garrett Atkins comparison that I like is starting to break down because Garrett Atkins never went six innings in a game. And now Stephen Piscotty, who's done some spot release during the year. He's even auditioned as the closer. We know he's got arm strength. His younger brother pitches for Duke. But now this guy's in the weekend rotation for Stanford and starting to work. How does Stephen Piscotty change Stanford's identity?
Well, you know, you're right. It's been a huge factor for them these last 2 weeks, I think, because they just hadn't, all year long, they hadn't found that consistency in the weekend rotation, in the Sunday spot. You know, it's been a bit of a revolving door. I mean, you know, we talked about how they had the major, for a while there early on, Logan Hochstatter, and they had AJ Venegas in there, and, you know, they've tried different things, and this is, I think, finally gives them that stability, and, you know, it allows them to just kind of keep Venegas in the bullpen, where I think he's pretty darn good, and that stabilizes the bullpen, you know, gives you the everyone knows their roles. I mean, that's nice to have that, and I think he's well suited for that role. So, I mean, Piscotty's got really good stuff. I mean, he's a lower slot guy with some real life and some velocity and a hard breaking ball. And he's done a good job each of his last 2 weeks pitching into the seventh inning, only allowing one earned run each week. And he's not walking too many guys. I mean, for a guy who's only got two career starts, you know, those are pretty nice little lines. I mean, only two walks and one run over six and a third.
It really seems like Stanford now finally kind of has those five or kind of that six guys that you look for teams to have in the postseason. Piscotty, Venegas, Appel, Mooneyham, obviously, and then kind of David Schmidt, and I would guess Dean McArdle is kind of that sixth guy.
Right. I would say so.
So there's some veterans, some strike throwers, some power arms. You got a lefty. If they need to go seven, I suppose there's a, you know, I don't know, is Hochstatter hurt? Or is he just not pitching? Has he just fallen out of favor?
I think he's just hit the freshman wall a little bit, is my understanding.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, maybe they're looking for the left-hander out of the bullpen as the one thing you're kind of looking for. But it feels like they're starting to come together for a postseason run. And I think we both know they still haven't found their 100% of their stride offensively. Or maybe this is just who they are. Maybe they aren't as good as we thought they were. I do think it's amazing that Danny DeKroger now has more home runs than Kenny DeKroger. Kenny has two, yeah. Danny has three. But they seem like a lineup that has some depth. They have some options. They can mix and match a little bit. And they have some guys in there who are consistent. Regeer has been quite consistent for them this year. Austin Wilson's been pretty consistent. And Piscotty is a rock. So Stephen Piscotty starting to make – if he'd started for a few more weeks, he'd be in that college player of the year mix for me. I mean, just with the two-way value – it's pretty big year. I don't even know if he's going to be the Pac-10 player of the year, though, the way that people in the Pac-12 love Tony Renda.
They do love Tony Renda. And Jeff Jelich has had a huge year. I think he's got right in that conversation. And, you know, I think maybe you can throw Joey DeMichael's name out there. You could throw, you know, there's a bunch of candidates. I mean, Arizona has some guys who've had some really nice years for them. But it's going to be a very interesting Pac-12 player of the year race.
I mean, Aaron, we talked about National Coach of the Year last podcast. National Player of the Year. I mean, that's just not a that's not an easy call. I mean, the first name I think of is our midseason Player of the Year, Mike Zunino. He's going to be the highest drafted college position player. We feel pretty certain about that. He's had a very good year, especially when you put it in the bats context, when you put him behind the plate. I think he's still the leader in the clubhouse, isn't he?
He's up to 15 home runs now. He's had a little bit of a power surge the last week or two, it feels like. And, you know, the guy hitting 324 doesn't feel like a slam dunk, certainly Player of the Year candidate. But, I mean, and that's the thing is, you know, every year since I've been, you know, the lead guy on this college beat, John, we've had a pretty much easy choice for Player of the Year. It was David Price. It was Steven Strasburg. It was Buster Posey. You know, even last year it was help me out, John. Who was it last year?
Oh, 2 years ago was Anthony Rendon.
I don't
even remember who it was last year. That's sad. It had to be a pitcher. It was Trevor Bauer, and that was slam dunk.
Trevor Bauer, slam dunk, absolutely. All those guys were slam dunks, and, you know, in some cases you had a strong number two, like, you know, I think Holston was a really good second choice last year.
Gordon Beckham in 2008. I remember
Gordon,
Posey was
sure,
awesome,
Gordon
Beckham was right there.
Yeah. I mean, and Ackley had a great year that year that Strasburg.
Correct.
Was the guy. But, I mean, there was always the guy. And this year it just seems muddled. I mean, you've got Zunino and Ramsey are still right there at the top of the discussion. I mean, you got to throw a guy hitting 470 into the mix. I mean, you know, for LSU.
Yeah, you're right. Ray
I think
Ron.
I think Kevin Gausman should be in the mix. I mean, he's had a fantastic year. You know, maybe Mark Appel has thrown his candidacy into this discussion. I mean, it's interesting. I think there's a bunch of good names.
There's a bunch of good names. There's certainly not a great name. Like you said,
that's exactly.
Zunino with a 386 on base. I mean, he's slugging 657, and he's a catcher. It's pretty impressive to see a catcher slugging 657. I mean, and, you know, he's thrown out 31.5% of opposing base runners. I mean, that's good. Let's talk a little bit about Florida. We're talking about great teams today. We're talking about top eight national seeds. The Gators are a lock. But, Aaron, on top of that, my boy Paco Rodriguez, I just went to bat hard in last week's top 200 meeting for Paco Rodriguez, and he goes and blows one to Auburn. Stay hot, Paco. But it feels like they're starting to get back to who we thought they were. Carsten Whitson's still not 100%, but Hudson Randall, I know that his velocity, I was talking to a scout who saw him this weekend. I think he topped out at 90 miles an hour against Auburn, and that's where he peaked. And he pitched in that mid to upper 80s, but a complete game, three hit shutout. You know he had to be pitch efficient to go complete game for Kevin O'Sullivan. It feels like Hudson Randall's back to being Hudson Randall.
Yeah.
Austin Maddox, Paco Rodriguez, Greg Larson, the bullpen. They've got Johnny Magliazzi as a power arm. They've got Jonathan Crawford and Brian Johnson. They've got the versatility. It feels like Florida still hasn't gotten hot offensively. They're 20-15 in their last 35 games, and yet it feels like they're starting to round into form, Aaron, at least to me.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, Whitson maybe isn't going – He's still being careful with him. They're being cautious. He's only going, 80, 90 pitches a week, it seems like. I don't think he's
right.
Hit 100 all year, but he is healthy. I mean, he is 100% of the stuff is good. And so, you know, that's important. And you're absolutely right about Randall. I mean, the last month here, he's been really good. He's returned to being Hudson Randall, and, you know, he's going to be in that 86 to 90 range. That's just who he is. But, I mean, you watch him on TV. I've seen him now a couple of times, and his stuff is good. You know, I mean, he's really – he knows how to pitch, and he looks like the guy that dominated last year. I mean, he's back.
Without the mullet.
All the way, so
he doesn't have the mullet like he did.
The mullet.
I mean, if he really was going to be the
right guy,
I thought the power for him was in his mullet. I'm disappointed. I want the ginger mullet back.
That was a good one.
I want the ginger mullet back in ball.
But, you know, I mean, when Florida was going through its little funk – way through the year, you talk to Kevin O'Sullivan, and he wasn't ever worried. You know, he's always like, well, you know what? I mean, we just want to be there at the end. We want to be healthy at the end, and we want to peak at the end. And he always had his eye on that, and he always thought his team was just fine, perfectly on track to be where they wanted to be. You know, and that's one of the things we talked about this last year when we gave Kevin O'Sullivan our our National Coach of the Year award and caused an uproar in Gamecock Nation. you know, this guy, one of the things that we like about him is that he has a sense for the bigger picture, and that's true when it comes to protecting pitchers, and is true with trying to win. You know, I mean, he doesn't obsess about midweek games because they're not that important. You know, and even weekend games. I mean, he's not gonna, you know, get out of whack trying to win a weekend series in March. You know, I mean, this guy, he's got his eyes on the prize. They're here to win a national championship, and I completely agree with you that this team suddenly looks really, really dangerous again. And the offense still hasn't clicked completely. You're right, but I feel like the power started to come back now with Zanino and Tucker, especially, and you look at that staff, and all of a sudden with Randall being Randall, and Brian Johnson's been a lot better, I think, lately, and Whitson's back, and now that allowing you to move Crawford to the bullpen if you want, or that number four starter, just an extra power arm, really big arm, to go with Maddox, Larson, and Rodriguez. I mean, that is so imposing.
It really is. Just in the interest of fairness, since I busted on James Ramsey with his sub-300 batting average, here's Mike Zanino's numbers in SEC play. 255. 336 on base. Now, he is slugging .509, and he leads the Southeastern Conference with 13 doubles in league play. It looks like your boy Matt Snyder with 10 home runs leads the league in home runs, by the way. Aaron Fitt and I think have
Johnny.
A Matt Snyder bet born. Yeah. Take that, Yanni's right. Chris Stratton has actually been, in conference play, the best pitcher in the Southeastern Conference. I don't know why I'm sounding a little surprised by that. Kevin Gausman, 5-1, 344. He has 87 strikeouts in 73 innings. Chris Stratton, 6-1, 205, with 88 strikeouts in 74 and two-thirds innings. So, I mean, like, as good as the prospects have been, and hey, Chris Stratton's a great prospect. You know, he's going to be a first-round pick. But Gausman's a better prospect. Stratton's been a little bit better this year. And that allows me to transition, Aaron, into later in the rankings, where we brought in Arkansas and Mississippi State. But the Bulldogs are the more interesting of those two teams. We've talked about them some this year. So this is a team that's been through so many injuries in its lineup. I believe at one point they had 6 of their 9 opening day players were out of the lineup. And yet their pitching has been so stout. And they really took it to – oh, I'm even blanking on who they swept this weekend. Who did they sweep this weekend?
Kentucky.
They took it to Kentucky. I mean, they destroyed Kentucky with a couple of close games and then blew it open on Sunday. But they only allowed 7 runs the whole weekend against a Kentucky team that really had been – quite offensive all year. How good is Mississippi State? Are they putting themselves – I mean, I feel like if they win the conference tournament, they're going to be a one seed and a host.
You know, they certainly have a chance, but here's my concern is that it's too little too late because I feel like traditionally the committee, you know, they don't put a ton of stock in the conference tournament. You know, they look – I mean, let's say they don't look at it, but it feels like a lot of times, you know, a hot team that wins a conference tournament, it still doesn't kind of change the committee's opinion. I mean, Virginia comes to mind in 2009 when they won the ACC tournament and still got shipped out to Irvine. And I feel like that happened to Florida State one year too, where they the year that they got sent to Connecticut, maybe they had won the ACC tournament and still got sent on the road. But you know, I feel like it's just going to be hard for Mississippi State to leapfrog some of these teams ahead of them. I mean, I look at the hosting picture right now, you know, and last week I had Texas A&M outside the top 16, and I felt like they should host. They feel like a host, and I just know who do you displace? I mean, there's 4 Pac-12 teams now that I think those top 4 teams are all very solid host candidates. You know, we talked about Oregon, UCLA, Stanford. I like Arizona's resume a lot. You know, Cal State Fullerton. Now, I mean, they've had a great season. I know that their RPI has sunk a little bit in the Big West play, but I think they're number 20 now in the RPI. Maybe they get left out, but I don't know that it's for Mississippi State because, you know, if you take out Fullerton and put in A&M, who's now up to number 8 in the RPI, they finished second, they finished strong in the Big 12. A&M looks like they're going to host. So, I mean, I'm running. There's nobody else you can really kick out. I mean, Purdue's going to host. You know, Rice, they won their league. They're going to host. Virginia has a better resume than you know, Mississippi State, I think. And I don't love Virginia's resume. They don't have a lot of quality wins for me. But, you know, they're higher in the RPI, number 11 in the RPI. You know, that's Mississippi State is number 29. So, I mean, you know, it's I don't think it's going to happen for the Bulldogs, no matter what happens in Hoover.
I think you're right. You really lay it out like that. To me, it feels like the top 15 teams in our ranking should host and then Purdue. That's how it feels like to me.
I agree. I think that's what I got as well.
I mean, Virginia has a nice case, solid resume. I think Purdue won its league versus fourth or fifth place in a league. Geography helps. That's where I'm looking at it. Just touching on the Bulldogs real quick. In conference play, in SEC play, 228, 339, 311. That's their slash line. And if you think they're scoring runs by running on people, that would be a negatory. They're 7 for 21 stealing bases in the league. How on earth is this team scoring any runs? Nice job by John Cohen.
Hit batsman, Johnny. Hit batsman.
That's it. I think you have to give them credit for John Cohen and that coaching staff deserve a lot of credit for there has been a little woe with me, like, because they talk about their injuries a lot. But
yeah, they do.
But the team hasn't wilted from that, and I respect that crazily. Second in the league in ERA.
I completely agree.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted. Did you? But I mean, I agree with you. I think that it would have been easy for this team to roll over at several points this season, and they haven't. You know, they've really, considering how anemic their offense is. I mean, they've had to scrap and claw, it seems like every weekend, and now they've won four of the last five series. Even at Gainesville, I think they were very competitive last week. And you know, to shut down Kentucky, you talked about it. I mean, they have the best offense in the SEC. That just shows you how good this Mississippi State pitching staff is. I mean, to me, the fact that they don't even necessarily need Caleb Reed to close anymore. I mean, they found a guy with Jonathan Holder, the freshman, that has been their closer lately. So, I mean, Reed is, you know, he's a great kind of moment of truth guy, but they don't even need him. They don't even save him for the end of the game. They've just got so many arms. Jacob Lindgren is a left-hander that they love, a freshman with a power-breaking ball that came in and pitched very well this weekend. That's kind of an X-factor guy to watch for them. I mean, Luis Poyarena, you know, another little lefty we like. I mean, the two Mitchells. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Just so many good arms on this team.
Yeah, it's really I think they're dangerous as well. I think they're very dangerous in the postseason because they're pitching. They're pitching depth. They're a team that can lose a first game of a regional or lose in a regional and battle back to a loser's bracket because of their pitching depth. It's the Baseball America podcast with John and Aaron. Let's wrap up, Aaron, by talking about a couple of coaching changes that happened this weekend because they're both in BCS leagues. They're interesting teams. You have West Virginia now moving
to Big 12.
Both Big 12. That's right. I never even thought about it that way. But we've had this down year in the Big 12. The coming tumult in the Big 12, not just Missouri leaving the league and A&M leaving the league, but now you have West Virginia coming into the league, and they – basically, it seems like Oliver Luck, their famous athletic director as the father of Andrew Luck, has basically said, Greg Van Zandt, the university, thanks you for your service. Now we care about baseball now that we're going to the Big 12. We have to step up our game in baseball. So therefore, we're going to make a coaching change so we can try to, you know, be relevant in baseball. Thank you for Jed Giorko and Tyler Kuhn and all those guys. We're moving on. It's not you. It's me. We're going to go get a new head coach. Is that how that feels? And what's, you know, how good do you think West Virginia can be as a baseball program? It doesn't feel like that's a team that's naturally going to be better than, say, Kansas or Kansas State.
Right.
Or it seems like those two programs really have to have a lot come together to be regional teams.
You're right. I mean, West Virginia is in a lot of trouble going to this conference. I just, you know, it just seems such a terrible fit for baseball. I mean, it just, you know, don't get me started on conference realignment. I just think it's all a bunch of crap. And, you know, it really makes me angry. I can't even, the motives behind all this stuff, it just drives me nuts. But this makes no sense for baseball. And it hurts West Virginia. I think you had a better chance of winning the Big East tournament and getting in that way than you did as an at-large team in the Big 12. That's just not going to happen. I mean, they're so far behind the eight ball. I mean, they've got 8 or 8.5 scholarships. You know, I mean, and even if you get them up to fully funded, that just shows you how far they've got to go. I mean, this program, you know, I think it's impressive what Greg Van Zandt did there. All things considered, I mean, they won 35 or more games 3 out of 4 years there a couple of years ago. I mean, you know, they finished above 500 overall last year, and you know, they didn't this year, but they've got 8.5 scholarships for God's sakes, and they've got, you know, not good facilities. I mean, they like you said, they haven't cared about baseball, and all of a sudden they're going to the Big 12, and they decide they're going to care. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. I understand why they made the move. They think they need to make a splash, you know, and get a change in there. Fine, but you know, I think Greg Van Zandt did do a solid job there. I think that's worth acknowledging.
And then, Aaron, we're talking about Texas Tech. And that's a little bit more of a surprise in that it didn't work, and that Texas Tech has some baseball tradition. Larry Hayes put up some pretty gaudy numbers there over the years. You know, they had some nice players. Josh Bard always leaps to mind to me as a big leaguer who was there and was a big recruit for them. And this is before your time, I understand, but Josh Bard went to Cherry Creek High School where he was high school teammates with Darnell McDonald. That's a big high school in Colorado, Baseball Factory High School. And Texas Tech went up there and got a big-name recruit, switch-hitting catcher, came to college, was a really good player for them. And, you know, they had that ability as a program under Larry Hayes. They didn't always do it. A lot of times I think Larry was much more comfortable getting junior college players out of that area and grinding. But they were a pretty consistent regional team, both in the Southwestern Conference and the Big 12 with Larry Hayes. Then Dan Spencer comes in there. He's an alumnus, comes in kind of triumphantly at the end of his tenure at Oregon State as the assistant coach, recruiting coordinator. You know, Oregon State's winning with guys from that state on the field as they win back-to-back national championships. And it just never clicked in Lubbock for Dan Spencer. What's next and what's the ceiling for Texas Tech?
You know, that's a program that I do think can and should compete in the Big 12. And, you know, it's, again, if you're in the Big 12, you're going to go up against Texas every year, you know, and Baylor now and A&M is gone. So that should make it a little easier. But you got TCU coming in as a program that's really got it going, you know. So, I mean, that's kind of a wash for me, TCU or A&M. I mean, take your pick going forward.
I agree.
Maybe give A&M a slight edge because they're A&M, but both those teams have great coaches and they're great programs. So and you got Oklahoma, of course. I mean, so you got your kind of top end programs in this league that are, I think, in place here going forward. But you know, Texas Tech, they've got a stadium project over there. I mean, I can't remember the status on that, but I know they spent some money for a ballpark, and I don't know about the talent in West Texas, but it's a big name, you know, kind of Big 12 program. I do think you can compete there, and I think there's some candidates that come to mind. I mean, certainly Tim Tadlock, a guy that they spent a lot of money to pry away from Oklahoma in the middle of the winter this year to try to get that thing going. I mean, he's got a great reputation. I wouldn't be surprised if they just elevated him to the head job. But also, I think that a guy like Ray Birmingham is a name that you have to keep in mind here. You know, a guy that has turned New Mexico into a winner. I mean, Had they ever been to a regional before 2 years ago? Or maybe it had been 50 years.
It had been a 48-year drought, Aaron. And both those guys are pretty interesting. They have actually pretty similar resumes because they both won a lot in junior college. I'd forgotten that Tim Tadlock was the head coach at Grayson County Junior College, and he won back-to-back national championships at Grayson County, 1999-2000. And then I also forgot until writing the blog post this morning that Tim Tadlock's a Red Raider alum. He played 2 years at Hill Junior College, and then he played 2 years at Texas Tech. So I think they have two natural candidates that both make a lot of sense and a lot of upside as a program. I think West Virginia has to hope that they can find a guy like at Kansas State. I'm blank on the coach's name.
Brad Hill.
To me, that's the kind of guy West Virginia needs, is a guy like Brad Hill. Brad Hill won the Division II level, and he's a grinder. He knows what kind of players win in his system. He's been able to recruit some athletes, guys like Carter Jurica. I mean, that's a pretty high level athlete. They've been able to go out and get some guys, and AJ Morris. But that team has always been more the sum is better than the whole, the parts kind of thing at K-State, and they've grinded it against a lot of odds to be quite a successful program under Brad Hill. I have a lot of respect for Coach Hill. I don't even know him that well, but I have a lot of respect for what he's accomplished there. That's what West Virginia kind of has to try to find. And those guys are hard to find. I think a lot of schools are trying to find that. What Tim Tadlock and Ray Birmingham do that I love is they've had success at the junior college level. And then Ray Birmingham especially has taken the JC success and shown that you can do it at the D1 level. And I wish that more athletic directors looked at that and junior college coaches who win, like Coach Johnson down at Chipola. There are a lot of them out there. Scott Pickler at Cypress always comes to mind. if I were a Pac-12 athletic director, and thank God I'm not, but if I were a Pac-12 athletic director and I needed a baseball coach, I'm going to Cypress. I'm going to Scott Pickler and say, you win everywhere. You win at Cypress. You win at YD. Your player's a good player. You win with prospects. You win with not prospects. Your sons are in pro ball. I mean, your sons win. I mean, to me, the Wayne Graham example should be enough, but it feels like there's a glass ceiling, and it's very difficult for JC guys to get Division I head coaching jobs. And I hope that Ray Birmingham's success leads to other guys getting a shot, because that guy's had a lot of success at New Mexico. And they might go to three straight regionals. That's insane at New Mexico.
It's amazing.
To go to three straight regionals.
It's amazing.
It's really Aaron,
right now they've got their RPI into a situation, John, where they actually have a chance in at-large, you know, and that's, I mean, you know, I mean, they're probably on the outside looking in for an at-large, but they're at least in the mix. And you stack their resume up with East Carolina, who has a much better RPI. I like New Mexico's resume more. We talked about this today in the top 25 meeting, but and you know, and one more JC coach that comes to mind, you know, that in the same conference, I mean, UNLV with Tim Chambers.
Great.
I think he's doing a really good job building that program, and that's I think will be a success story as well.
That's a great point. I will say, I know Tim, that there was a little bit of a mess after him at College Southern Nevada, but he built that program from scratch at CSN and made it into a national power. Obviously, Bryce Harper didn't hurt, but that's another example, like you said, of a JUCO coach going to the Division I level and turning some things around. That's a great example to bring up. So there are a lot of guys all over the country, you know, like they've been struggling at UW over the years. I think Lindsey Meggs has made good progress there. You know, Mark Ischino has been a great JC coach in the Pacific Northwest for a long time. You know, I wonder if that guy ever really got a shot at the UW job. You know, for a lot of junior college coaches who have a long track record of success, who I think I hope would get a shot at the Division I level, but. That about does it for me for the podcast, Aaron. Obviously, we're excited. We're going to see you this week. Bison North Carolina Barbecue, ACC tournament. Conference tournaments in college baseball are, I don't know if I even say they're necessary evil. They're unnecessary. They're definitely not evil, but they seem almost irrelevant to me. I mean, it's
right.
Hard to get too jacked or pumped about any conference tournaments. Which is another reason that the SEC separates itself from everyone else, because the SEC tournament does matter to those fans, to those coaches, to those players, not as much as it, you know, as they do maybe in college basketball for some of these sports, some of these leagues. But conference tournaments in baseball just don't seem like they excite the fan base, to use the talk show phrase.
Yeah, and right now, you know, to me the most fascinating thing about this week is the conferences where you've got an automatic bid on the line and that's it. I mean, or where maybe you've got one other team that could make a regional. So, I mean, if TCU, for instance, doesn't win the Mountain West, or Coastal Carolina doesn't win the Big South, and you're looking at one fewer at-large spots go around for these bubble teams. But so that, to me, is what you really want to watch this week. I'll be in Greensboro at the ACC tournament because I think it's a great opportunity to see eight teams in one spot. You know, and at least seven of those teams will be in regionals. I got Wake Forest now in the field after sweeping Clemson this weekend, and Georgia Tech, I think, has to play its way in with a couple of wins this week. I think they're really in precarious position, but 12-18 in the ACC doesn't excite me. But, you know, that to me is you know, it's the ACC tournament. Who really cares who wins? I don't care. But, I mean, I want to go there to watch these teams play a bunch of games and to see if Georgia Tech can kind of boost its position. Otherwise, there's not a whole lot on the line this weekend.
Very well said. You know, I meant to mention when we talked about the ACC that that's a shocking result to me. I thought Clemson was kind of on the come, and they were. They had really improved. But getting swept by Wake Forest, 32-24, I mean, Clemson looks like a three seed, Aaron, and I mean, why would you not stick them in Columbia in a regional? I mean, they haven't earned.
Because that would result in the apocalypse, apparently. That's what everyone tells me. Every time I have the audacity to suggest South Carolina and Clemson in a regional, everyone says, oh, that'll never happen. Never happen.
I think it's happening. I mean, I think the Tigers are going to have to wear it. They have not earned the right to be shipped anywhere else, I don't think.
Yeah.
Now, if there were a regional in the Northeast, it'd be great to ship Clemson up there. That's, you know, the State University of Vermont at Clemson. But I mean,
right, exactly.
But anyway, but Wake Forest, it does feel like kind of earned its way in, at least to a three seed. by yeah. sweeping that series. And that's, again, kudos to Tom Walter. That's another guy who, you know, they've overcome a lot at Wake Forest. That program had really bottomed out. And he's done a nice job building their talent back up and kind of a must-win series, and they go and sweep it, which is impressive. So we'll look forward to seeing you over in Greensboro, and I'll be there with you. So I'm going to visit in for a couple of – especially the morning games, the Wednesday and Thursday 11 a.m. games. I can go to a Wednesday morning 11 a.m. game in Greensboro and get some work done even while I'm there, and then come back and coach pitch the Mite League Phillies to victory.
Nice.
That's the plan. That's the plan on Wednesday, Aaron. So for Aaron Finn, I'm John Manuel. This Baseball America College Podcast is sponsored by ATEC, the baseball training machine company. At ATEC, we're committed to delivering tools to coaches to help train and develop players. Visit ATECsports.com to learn more about training machines that can help make your practice more effective and efficient. See training tips and practice drills from Vanderbilt head coach Tim Corbin and more on ATECsports.com. ATEC, win every practice. For Aaron Finn, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America Podcast. So long, everybody.